This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. This week, we're taking a closer look at COVID-19 outbreaks in a North State jail and prison, hearing from Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey and from an employee at the California Correctional Center in Lassen County. We'll also take a trip to Downeyville to learn more about the community's classic bike race that will not be happening there this year due to the pandemic. If you have questions or comments, leave them on our message line 433-9216, or you can head to our website, mynspr.org. For Thursday, July 30th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. The North State has lost four more souls to the global pandemic, raising the region's death toll to 32, according to data available Thursday from local health officials. Two of the deceased hailed from Colusa County, one from Yuba, and a woman in her 80s from Shasta County. The fatalities come as some county and municipal officials consider measures to increase compliance with mask and distancing orders. North State coronavirus cases rose by another 112 Thursday to 3,445 across the 11-county region. 68 are hospitalized, up 2 from Wednesday. In terms of cases in individual counties, Butte County health officials report 907 positive cases, Sutter County 731, Yuba 441, Shasta 348, Glenn 315, Colusa 312, Tehama 227, Siskiyou 71, Lassen 59, Plumas 32, and Trinity County 5. Statewide, more than 10,000 additional cases were confirmed Thursday, according to the California Department of Public Health, putting the total at 485,502. Close to 60,000 Californians have contracted the virus over the past week. Fatalities jumped another 194 Thursday to 8,909 over the past week. 882 Californians have died from the illness. The statewide 14-day positivity rate, measuring the percentage of tests given that confirm an infection, remained at 7.5. Four North State counties, Colusa, Glenn, Lassen, and Sutter, have positivity rates higher than the state average. Butte County officials Wednesday called on all malls, gyms, places of worship, barbers and salons, nail massage and tattoo parlors, and non-critical offices to close immediately unless they can operate outdoors or conduct business curbside. The announcement comes as the county officially joined the state's county monitoring list. Like elsewhere in the region, local officials have been reluctant to issue fines and have thus far taken an educational approach to violations. Legislative Republicans accused Democrats of violating state Senate rules after they declined to allow a committee vote immediately ending the state of emergency and special powers granted to Newsom. On Thursday, State Senator Brian Jones of San Diego County accused Newsom of overstepping his authority with rushed mask purchases and orders closing beaches, parks, and shuttering businesses. Avoiding exposure to COVID-19 appears intertwined with economic status. Poorer people are less able to stay at home and less able to reduce interactions with others than the wealthy, according to a study published by UC Davis researchers Wednesday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. The study analyzed cell phone data. Researchers determined that the number of people strictly obeying stay-at-home orders increased by 25% in the wealthiest neighborhoods, while rising by just 10% in the poorest ones. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. One of the groups epidemiologists have grave concerns over during this pandemic are people in jails and prisons, as inmates have limited mobility, are typically in close quarters, and have no option to leave or change locations, even if an outbreak is happening around them. While most of the North State's jails have no cases or just a couple, the Butte County Jail in Oroville has dozens of inmates that have tested positive for COVID-19 since the pandemic began, with many of the cases detected in the last several weeks. NSPR's Andre Bayek spoke with Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey by phone on Thursday about the outbreak there. Andre first asked the sheriff to explain the extent of the spread of the virus at the facility.
As we sit here today, there are 53 individuals in custody who currently tested positive for COVID-19. 88 individuals have been released from their isolation period, recovered, and we're expecting another 38 to be released from their isolation period beginning tomorrow and through the weekend.
Do you have any indication as to how the virus may have been introduced at the jail?
No, I think from the very beginning, we worked hard to try to prevent the introduction of COVID into facilities, and then beyond that, mitigate its spread. I think that is consistent with what other segments of the community had done, as well as other correctional facilities throughout the state.
Can you share perhaps the nature of the illnesses related to COVID at the jail? Have there been any inmates who have fallen seriously ill or maybe even died?
No, we've had no death, thankfully. I'm very happy about that, of course. The vast majority of the inmates who experienced COVID-19 have either been asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. We had two individuals who were displaying reduced oxygen saturation levels that were sent to the hospital for observation. They were treated and subsequently released back to the jail. And as we sit here today, there are no inmates in the hospital as a result of COVID-19. In addition to that, we've had 9 staff members who have tested positive. All of them have also been either asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic.
What measures are taken after an inmate tests positive for COVID?
Sure. So I think I'd like to start with the stuff that we do from the very beginning. So early on, and we continue to do this, set up screening for individuals who enter the facility. That includes a member of our medical staff meeting the detainee and the arresting officer outside the facility. Their temperature is taken. They're asked questions as to whether or not they might be symptomatic or have been in contact with somebody who's been diagnosed with COVID-19. Depending on how they answer those questions, if they have a temperature or they have expressed contact with somebody, we have the capacity to isolate them or send them to be cleared. If they're not, when they're brought into our booking facility, they're required to wear a mask while they're in there. If they're not released pursuant to law and they're housed, try to do is house them in an area that meets their classification needs, but obviously isn't a housing unit that is isolated because of a positive COVID-19 test. Once they're in the facility, if there is a positive test and there is an outbreak within a housing unit, what we do is do our best to isolate those individuals who have either tested positive or have been exposed to somebody and isolate them from other inmate housing units that have not tested positive or have not been exposed.
Just a quick follow-up to that. Is it realistic to be able to separate individuals who have tested positive for COVID from the jail population that does not have COVID or has not yet tested positive for COVID?
Well, it's certainly a challenge. And one of the things that we ultimately have been doing is trying to manage population to maintain capacity within the facility. So as you know, because you've done a number of stories on the jail, our capacity at BKH jail is 614. We have 614 beds. Today, our population is around 476. So we have about 200 open beds. But you also know that not all beds are created equally, as I've said in the past, in terms of how you house individuals based on their classification or their needs. A good example of that is our medical housing unit. Right now, I only have 3 beds within our medical wing. That's one of the reasons that I'm working so hard to get a new facility that has increased capacity with regard to our ability to handle inmates with medical or mental health issues. But ultimately, one of the ways in which we do that is trying to maintain capacity, quarantining an entire housing unit. And it certainly is not without challenge by any stretch of the imagination, but we are working to do that.
You mentioned the reduction in inmates and the daily population at the jail. Do you have the discretion to perhaps further decrease the number of individuals who are held there?
We were given some increased authority with regard to our consent decree from the court to make releases within guidelines and within parameters. And that's a complex balance of competing interests that we have to deal with on a daily basis, but also to deal with other interests of public safety. Certainly, you cannot release everybody from the jail. There are individuals, they've demonstrated they pose an increased threat to public safety, and there are other individuals that we cannot release by law.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about the jail and COVID that you'd like to add or perhaps clarify?
Well, obviously, we're taking it very seriously. We're doing our best to try to mitigate the spread. I'm thankful at this point that we haven't had any of our inmates or staff members fall seriously ill or suffer death. That's something that we're working hard to prevent. But this is an extremely challenging situation. I think that we're certainly by no means alone dealing with these challenges. It is an issue that is being dealt with throughout the community, throughout the state of California, both in the general public as well as other correctional facilities. And so we're continuing to adjust to an ever-changing environment, update our procedures based on new guidance that comes out. And I think that's been one of the more particularly challenging aspects of this is an ever-evolving process. As new information comes out, we try to adopt and incorporate it to make sure that we're utilizing the best practices of the day.
That was Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. More just ahead.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai. And from iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware. At iDrive.com/NPR. Support for NPR comes from this station and from MD Anderson Cancer Center, offering lymphoma treatments, including CAR-NK therapy. More at MDAndersonLymphoma.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. RWJF.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource committed to offering inspiration and information about what works in K-12 education. More at edutopia.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. State prison officials have said they've been on the virus from the outset, but an outbreak at San Quentin Prison that has affected more than a third of inmates and killed 19 people has apparently also spread to the California Correctional Center, or CCC, in Lassen County through a prisoner transfer. According to the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, as of Thursday, 555 of the CCC's inmates and 10 employees have contracted the virus. Statewide, 8,000 inmates and 1,700 employees have tested positive. In a recent article in the Lassen County Times, a person describing themselves as a CCC employee said guidelines and protocols aimed at stopping the spread of the virus were haphazardly enforced. This employee said a largely cavalier attitude persists on the inside of the facility, contributing to an outbreak authorities are struggling to control. NSPR's Mark Albert recently spoke with the anonymous source for the Lassen County Times story. We have granted the source's request to conceal their identity due to concerns that speaking to us could cost them their job. To ensure confidentiality, this interview has been transcribed and re-recorded by NSPR staff.
Now, you're troubled not only about the spread and mixing in the prison, but that with so many people in Lassen County working there in some capacity, your major worry is that it will slip into the community and cause major harm.
That's correct. You have people that work at the prison, whether they're custody, free staff, or medical professionals, and people live all over the place. They live in all different sorts of counties in California and even Reno. My fear is that it's going to spread outside the prison and start spreading in all these individual communities because no one's taking it serious. and there's really no enforcement from the top down, even if they're setting what they think are consistent policies, but there's really no way for them to know that they're actually, you know, being performed that way. If you got a sergeant that 90% of the time oversees custody, but they're never actually going around to supervise, they're just staying inside their buildings or whatever their office is, and there's no way for them to know that staff or inmates or anybody is actually following the policies that are supposed to be in place.
Now, everything was fine until four prisoners were transferred from San Quentin prison, where there was an outbreak. And these folks didn't have symptoms. It was assumed that they were not infected, and it turned out later that they were. According to CDCR, on Thursday the 16th, CCC prison now has 223 cases. In a story in the Lassen Times, which I understand you were a major source for, you said inmates perform important functions in the prison and that to control the spread, they really should be confined and relieved of their jobs, at least until it can be determined who's been infected and who hasn't. But prisoners were put back to work pretty quickly. And you said in recent days, in the kitchen alone, two workers there have tested positive and the prisoners were out distributing meals.
Yes, inmates work inside the prison because it's basically a city inside the prison when it's normal and there's not a pandemic. They have jobs they go to every day and it should help them feel more enriched and help them rehabilitate. The problem is with the pandemic that's going on. We didn't really go on lockdown until the very end of June to maybe the beginning of July. So all the way from March until then, inmates were having regular program. You know, day room yard, what they call MAC reps, that were commingling with other buildings and stuff like other buildings or yards. The problem is if you have a pandemic, if the goal is to stop the spread, you cannot have them out performing those duties. The best way to stop the spread is to just keep every inmate, no matter where they live, on any facility, in their area where they live. Do not move them, even if they're test positive. Keep them there. And let 14 to 21 days go by, test everybody, and then you'll really know for sure if you've gotten rid of it. Instead, the prison has a tendency, after a couple of days on lockdown, to kick those inmates out of their dorms and get them back in their jobs.
Is the concern that essentially putting an entire prison in solitary confinement for 2 or 3 weeks could cause a prison-wide riot? Or is the concern that it's just not necessary?
I think it might be a little of both in terms of before we actually had the outbreak, people kind of thought COVID wasn't a real thing. On top of that, I think they're always, CBCR is always worried about lawsuits. I mean, that's kind of always been there, the thing that drives policy within a department. So I think that's a major player. I mean, you're not going to have a prison riot if everybody's locked down. There has been times when they've broken out of dorms and stuff like that, but that's very rare. If they're on a true lockdown and you're feeding them where they live and you just, you talk to the inmates and communicate to them and let them know, hey, this is what's going on. It's for your safety. It's for our safety. It's for everyone's safety, more or less. I don't think you're really going to have riots. When this first started, we had a positive case in the kitchen where they serve the food and they make the food in the trays go out to all the inmates. Well, just recently, we had another one do the same when they took the inmates out. And the administration deemed critical workers, put them back in the kitchen. And now we have another case of a positive worker in the kitchen.
Is it that the prison really can't function without prisoners doing work and that it would be too disruptive? Or are they really concerned about putting everybody essentially in solitary and having deleterious effects?
I think it's a little both. But the prison can function without the inmates if it really needs to. It's just staff aren't really used to performing those duties that the inmates do all the time. It's just easier and more convenient to come out with a list of what they deem critical workers and get them out working so it makes it easier for everyone else to fall in line and get those things that have to be done in a timely manner done.
You've also raised some issues in the article in the Lassen Times about protocols, both for guards entering the prison and also for the inmates themselves. You say that the guards, when you go in for the temperature check, that if somebody says, oh, I'm feeling okay, even if they're coughing or look kind of sick, they're admitted. The place where people's temperature is taken is very cramped and has four or five people standing really closely, and that inmates, when they are found to have been infected, they are moved and isolated in building three, but their roommates are left where they are, so potentially spreading it around. Officials have to be aware the protocols, the guidance is all out there, but you say that the way that the guidance is being implemented is leaving a lot to be desired.
As far as staff are concerned, whenever you enter the prison, they do the test and it normally is cramped, no matter which way you're going in. You should have a medical staff, you should have a supervisor, and then you're going to have a regular cop who checks IDs to make sure that the people coming in and going out are who they say they are. I personally, yes, have witnessed staff members coming in through the check and are clearly sick. As long as they tell the person you know at the door, hey, I'm good to go, they let them in. I mean, I haven't seen anyone refused. As far as inmates are concerned, there are positive inmates on all the facilities. There's four facilities at CCC. That's actually five if you count the camp, and all of them have positive cases. They do move inmates, and they do leave their cellies, you know, or the doormates, and they move them out to building three. Or there are supervisors that make the decisions to leave them on their lower yards or Arnold unit. But the problem is that inconsistency. So you'll have a supervisor that will make the decision to leave them on the lower yards. But then the next day, you'll have a different supervisor that comes in and goes, no, move that one guy that's positive up to the last 10 yards. But leave the other 20 inmates that he lives with in the dorm room right where they are. So you're just moving it around. You're basically just playing hot potato or a shell game with COVID-19.
You also say that the doorknobs are not being sterilized, that people are having their temperatures checked with a thermometer, and the thermometer is not sterilized between persons.
I've personally never witnessed a thermometer used on staff be sterilized. As far as the inmates are concerned, it depends on the medical staff that are working that day, because a lot of the times they don't really seem to know who's even positive. They've asked custody, you know, like, do you know who the positive cases are? But we're not supposed to know because of HIPAA. It should be medical who knows that. So the sheer fact that they're asking that is just scary.
That was an employee of the California Correctional Center speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. This source was granted anonymity due to fears that speaking out could cost them their job. Their side of the interview was transcribed and re-recorded by NSPR staff to conceal their identity. For this story, NSPR also reached out to obtain interviews from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and Lassen County Public Health. Calls and emails to Lassen County Public Health officials specifically for comment about the outbreak at CCC were not returned. CDCR declined a recorded interview, but spokespersons Terry Hardy and Jeffrey Callison gave a comment in writing. In addition to citing precautions and protocols enacted throughout the entire California prison system, Hardy wrote that CCC immediately implemented a program reducing movement when the initial four cases were identified. Hardy also wrote that cleaning and disinfection efforts were stepped up, a command post was established in addition to mass testing, and there was adoption of all CDC guidelines for the incarcerated. In comparison to CCC's 555 inmate cases, High Desert State Prison has reported four cases, and the Federal Correction Institute Herlong, also in Lassen County, has reported one. For the past two decades, thousands of cyclists have descended on the Sierra County town of Downeyville during the last weekend in July. But this year, for the first time ever, the 27-mile Downeyville Classic is not happening because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporter Nina Sparling has the story of how the cancellation is more than a letdown for cyclists. It's a big hit for local businesses.
I think I like biking because it's just like super gnarly and fast. It's like right here in town. We can go from town.
Jesse Folsom and Jake Sainsbury had planned to spend this weekend gripping the handlebars of their mountain bikes, race numbers pinned to their jerseys, with an eye on the finish line on Main Street in their hometown. Jake was a novice last year.
I mean, like, doing it for the first time, it's like a serious rite of passion. Yeah. Rite of passage, it felt like. And it's like, it's, are you going to come back, like, puking and, like, with a broken bone, or are you going to come back, like, victorious, you know?
Jesse and Jake are the Downeyville High mountain bike team. Jake's dad is their coach, and the boys have been training all year for this year's Downeyville Classic. The race brings everyone from high schoolers to pro racers from all corners of the globe. But this year, it's not happening.
It's so disappointing.
It's like the biggest event of the summer.
Yeah, it's like the one thing that we all look up, like, just are so stoked about. It's like, yeah. It's like Christmas, but
in the middle of the summer.
Yeah.
The whole town lights up for the event. Greg Williams started the bike race in 1995.
So Saturday, the event, it starts in Sierra City, and it comes up the face of the Sierra Buttes, and then it hits Packer Saddle. And from Packer,
the race is actually two races, one on Saturday and one on Sunday.
The third divide, first divide, and then comes right down Main Street into downtown Downeyville.
It's a gnarly, gnarly ride. It's intense.
In the heat, like, super hot out.
Yeah, you start at like 9.
It's like, what, a 7-6 mile climb? Yeah,
in short, the rides are hard. And race weekend is kind of like a 3-day party for the whole town. The decision to cancel the 25th anniversary of the event was a tough one, but Greg really didn't see any other option.
You know, we start to attract a lot of people from all over the world, and Downeyville's not ready for that right now. We don't want to be the organization that tried to help save the town that took it out. The financial risk is far less than the risk to people's health.
And so Greg knows it's not just tough on him and his business. Jared Donahue works at a bike shop in town, and he's also the assistant coach of the Downeyville High mountain bike team.
It's tough, I think, because it's like, well, who knows if it's the right thing or the wrong thing. It's like, right. Would there be two bike shops next summer? Like, would the taqueria thrive? Like,
he's worried about what the cancellation means for the Downeyville economy. Jared moved here a year ago, and he's a regular at the taqueria in town. Feather Ortiz runs the restaurant and a nursery across the street. Sierra County has been home since 1973, when she left Southern California for the mountain life. She saw the economy teeter in the 90s.
Because logging went bad and mining went bad. We didn't have the economy. And then the mountain bikers came in and the bike shops came in.
Mountain bikers keep Downeyville on the map and her restaurant open.
They have saved this town from going into a little ghost town, you know, and that's a big deal.
Feather decided to open back up in June when the first wave of restrictions lifted in Sierra County. So now, cyclists and meandering tourists do stop in for burritos and tacos, but without the big race weekend and all the other events that got canceled this summer, not having that business is going to make things harder for her.
Brings a lot of money into town. It keeps our businesses alive.
The race is also one of the few times of year that the locals don't have to leave Downeyville to be in a crowd. Mia Martinelli is going to be a sophomore at Downeyville High. She could care less about mountain biking, but was still pretty eager for race weekend.
And there's a lot of cute boys that come up. So when that got canceled, I was a little bit disappointed.
Jesse and Jake are bummed too, if for different reasons. Nina Sparling, Cap Radio News.
That story is part of our rural reporting project on Plumas and Sierra counties with Cap Radio. You can hear the entire project at capradio.org/rural or at mynspr.org. And that is your program. As always, if you have thoughts for us, you can leave them on our message line 433-9216 or on our website, mynspr.org. Before we go, I do have some news that I wanted to tell you personally. Friday will be my last day at NSPR, as I'm leaving the station to attend graduate school this fall. I have learned a tremendous amount in my past 7 years here, and we have been through so much as a community. It has been an honor being your news director. Thank you so much for listening and for supporting this station.